Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you with us. We're also pleased this morning in this hour of Focus 580 to be talking with Congressman Tim Johnson. He is now in his third term representing Illinois' 15th congressional district. He is a Republican. It's a big district, you may know. It stretches all the way from Livingston County in the north all the way down to kind of the edge of southern Illinois, southeastern Illinois, at that place where Indiana and Kentucky and Illinois all come together. Includes a number of cities, including Champaign-Urbana, Danville, Mattoon, Charleston. From time to time, he joins us on the program to give people the opportunity to have some direct access to their representative in Congress. And we thought now this would be a good time to do it. We have a new Congress. They've been at work now for a couple of weeks. The president has given a couple of major speeches about budgetary issues and the State of the Union. And so we thought it would be a good opportunity to take some time to talk with the congressman and also to give you all who live in the 15th district, a chance to talk with him as well. So that's what we're doing here in this first part of Focus 580. We ask only one thing of people who call, and that is that people in their comments and their questions are as brief as they can be, as we would like to give as many different people a chance to talk with him as possible. So all you need to do to get in here on the conversation is to pick up the telephone and give us a call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. I think we have a little bit of a trouble with the phones here, but I think that up now. So, once again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Congressman, hello.
Hello, David. How are you this
I'm
morning?
Fine, thanks. And how are you?
I'm fine. I'm glad that our mutual travels have not taken us today to Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, given that it's considerably colder there than it is here.
I can't quite imagine that it would be colder. It's as bad here in central Illinois as I ever expect to see it or would want to.
Yeah. No,
I really appreciate you giving us some of
your
time.
I appreciate your having me, and I appreciate the forum that you provide all the time.
There are, we're getting some people lined up, and there are a number of things that I would like to ask you about. Let me just pick one thing, and we could talk just a little bit here, and then we'll get to the callers.
Okay, I presume we're on the air now.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I assumed we were. Yes. Not that I'd say anything different, I just want to make sure.
And the thing that I wanted to ask you about was Iraq. And the president now, as everyone has heard, I'm sure, has said that he would like to send an additional 21,500 troops, and these would not be new recruits, but, I mean, they would be people that would have to be recruited from people who are already there, people who are back here, and to send them to Baghdad to try to improve security there. And a lot of members of Congress, many members, both Democrats and Republicans, have gone on record as saying they just don't think, what they say is that they don't think that it will help, that they will, it won't make things better, and all we would be doing is putting more American troops in harm's way. And I'm interested, I know you have gone on record saying what you think about this, but I'd like to give you opportunity again to give your reaction to, first of all, just to the president's plan to send these additional troops into Baghdad.
Well, let me say it as unequivocally as I can. I'm never enamored with politicians who try to, you know, give weasel words on both sides of an issue. I unequivocally do not support the escalation of 22,000 troops, additional American troops, into Iraq as proposed by President Bush. I do not believe that it would be effective. I think it would send American men and women, not to mention individuals in Iraq and around the world, into harm's way with no clear objective and with no clear strategy or even any strategy at all for what is considered quote-unquote victory. And I have made that clear both to the president, to the leadership, and to hopefully to my constituents. I certainly have supported, continue to support our men and women who are there serving this country, Middle East, and around the world. And I have, where I can, supported my president in a variety of endeavors. I do not, however, believe this is in our best interest, and I do not support it.
Let me ask you then the more difficult question, and that is, at this point, what do you think that the United States should be doing in Iraq?
I think the rough parameters of the Iraq Study Group, the Hamilton-Baker Consortium, provide a very good framework for our sooner rather than later withdrawal of American troops from Iraq. I don't think most people support immediate withdrawal. I don't think most people set or support the setting of a specific timeline. But I think the Iraq Study Group, involving the international community and the dialogue, and also the drawdown of American troops, really provides us a bipartisan, reasonable framework for eliminating our presence, at the degree anyway, anywhere near what we are now, in the Middle East. And while I can't tell you that every jot and tittle of the Iraq Study Group is something that I have studied in depth, I have studied at significant length the recommendations that they made, and I think provide us a pretty good framework for what I think is a reasonable course of action.
Mm-hmm. It seems, and again, I would say the same thing. I have probably not studied it in minute detail, but it's sort of my impression that the White House, the reaction of the president to the group was, thank you very much for your great service to the United States, and then they just took it and put it on a shelf somewhere and didn't seem interested in implementing any of it.
And it's befuddling to me, David. This group had everyone from Alan Simpson, a respected former member of the Senate, and Jim Baker, former Chief Justice or Justice O'Connor, to Lee Hamilton, to Leon Panetta, and others, and covering a wide variety on the spectrum, politically and probably philosophically. And I haven't seen any action from anyone, at least in the administration, indicating that there was anything other than a piece of paper. And I'm not here to trash President Bush. I'm not here to call President Bush a war criminal or any of the strident criticism that he's received from people. I'm sure he's intentioned well and in his own right. But to me, these recommendations have been ones that have been largely put on a piece of paper and largely ignored, and I think that's unfortunate.
Let me ask you just one more question, and then I promise people who are on hold I will get to them. I think that there is a concern about, a lot of people are concerned about what appears to be the growing tension between the United States, the government of the United States, and the government of Iran. And I think that there are many people who are concerned that the Bush administration might decide to take some kind of military action against Iran in Iran, perhaps not necessarily sending in troops, but some kind of an attack on Iran. Is that something that you would support?
Well, I can't imagine under current circumstances, from what I know now, that I would support a military action somewhere else in the world. Now, if we were to determine that, you know, nuclear missiles were aimed at the United States and various points in the Middle East, and they were about ready to be launched, or something of that magnitude, I'm not suggesting that would be the case, then I suppose we would look at it again, but I haven't seen that suggestion. We also heard the suggestion, obviously, and the thought before the invasion of Iraq that there were weapons of mass destruction, and there weren't. So I'm not closing any doors. I'm simply saying that at this point, I think that's the farthest thing from my mind. I think that Iran points to the underlying difficulty with involvement, frankly, anywhere around the world, but here as well. You have divisions, obviously, between the Shias, who now control the government within Iraq and who control, in a different sense, the Iranian government. You have divisions within that Shia movement between Sunnis and Shias. You obviously have the Kurdish involvement. And then you have the involvement in the interfacing of the Israeli-Palestinian crisis, as well as involvement of countries in the periphery. And I don't believe that we're ever going to be able, at this point anyway, to be able to deal with those nuances in such a way that we can ever emerge with what is going to be what I consider victory. We have succeeded in toppling a brutal dictator. We have established the semblances of a democracy. And we have made strides in striking at the root of terror, albeit in varying degrees of success. But there comes a point when you have to say, we've achieved, if that was our objective, and I'm not sure it was, but if that was our objective, David, we've achieved, to the extent we can reasonably expect to achieve it, our objectives. Now let's talk about what we need to do to bring American men and women at home, or to be redeployed into other areas around the world where we're already stretched too thin. And so I guess my position is one not of of cut and run, not of of needless sacrifice of individuals who are already there, but not of needless sacrifice of people who are going to go there. And so I simply have to say what I believe, and that's what I believe.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Congressman Tim Johnson. He represents the 15th Congressional District in Illinois and from time to time talks with us. And we want to, again, our reason for doing this show really is to create an opportunity for constituents, people in the 15th, to talk to him. And we have a number of callers here. We'll get in as many as we can. As I said at the beginning of the program, I would just ask callers, please, to try to be brief so that way we can get in as many different people as possible. You are sharing the space with others, so keep that in mind. So we'll start out with someone in Champaign, and this would be line number two. Hello.
Good morning, Congressional Congressman Johnson. Appreciate your time.
Well, I appreciate your calling in.
And your stance on Iraq and working with other Democrats indicates that you're willing to dialogue with others, and I think that's something that you should be proud of and that we're encouraging you. In terms of local issues, I was actually able to attend the congressional field hearing on the Protection of University Governance Act of 2006, and I was actually very disappointed by how who was represented, who wasn't represented. In particular, there were no Native people on your panel. No.
Well, before you go much farther, let me point out that was not my panel. I'm not a member of the Education and Workforce Committee. That's Congressman McEwen. I was simply there as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, and I'm not the one who chooses or doesn't choose the witnesses. I certainly would have some input on it, but I don't choose the witnesses. I don't choose the numbers. I don't choose the rules. Those are entirely within that committee, of which I'm not a member.
Okay. Well, in either case, on the mascot issue, it does seem that the Native community here is being ignored. The Board of Trustees has called for a consensus decree, and they have as yet engaged the Native American community. There's been a major climate of it is hostile and abusive, especially towards students of color. You know, there was an incident on Facebook where someone, you know, indicated that they wanted to stick a tomahawk in someone's face. There's been a lot of misinformation. There's been a lot of heated arguments happening on campus, and students are fearful. People are afraid of speaking out. There is going to be a public forum today, and it's going to be web streamed, so you would have a chance to check it out to see what exactly is happening on campus. I encourage you to see it.
Well, I'm actually going to be in Bement and Monticello and Sedoris and Tolono today, so I'm already committed.
We'll archive it just for you, and we'll send you out this information.
Sure.
The point being,
you're probably not going to change my position. The position is
it's not. We don't want to change your position at this point. We know you're not going to change it on the mascot, but we do think that you need to be involved in facilitating change on this campus. You know, we do need true dialogue. We do need to create a safer space before someone gets hurt.
Right. Well, let's get.
I certainly don't want to see people hurt or abused either. So, if that's your intention, I certainly would support you in trying to make sure that the environment isn't conducive to that.
Well, is this something that actually you think that the Congress of the United States has anything really to say about?
Yeah, in this respect, David, this legislation doesn't address the issue. I certainly would be the first to say that part of the impetus for Speaker Hatcher's and my legislation, Congressman Costello's legislation, was the situation with respect to the chief. This legislation applies across the country and simply reaches to the issue of the National Collegiate Athletic Association and its monopolistic position within the university community, and specifically says that rules and regulations with respect to cutting off of various rights within that organization have to be made, at least in these arenas, with respect to the governing boards, in our case the University of Illinois Board of Trustees or the University of North Dakota Board of Trustees or whatever they may be, rather than a 10-person executive committee that really operates as a federal monopoly with tax-free or tax-exempt status, with a position exempt from our antitrust laws and otherwise. So there is a position to take, not to specifically indicate what the respective governing bodies have to do, but to indicate that there are states' rights issues specifically the University of Illinois, University of North Dakota, and otherwise, to make their own decisions in their own right on those particular issues.
Well, again, I want to thank the caller and go on to someone next in Urbana. This would be line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Given that the distortions that we know about the decisions that led to the Iraq War, the abuse of power that the president has been doing, the torturing issue, the domestic spying issue, which cuts across the First Amendment, the political outing of a CIA agent, which we're pretty sure came from the administration, and the failure of to support the veterans we have at home here, and the politicization of science, in other words, to sort of bury information that the public needs to know. Do you feel the current administration has basically gone against their oath to defend and protect the Constitution of the United States? And if that is so, do you believe that you would support a bid to impeach this president and the current administration?
No, absolutely not. I think that the suggestion to talk about impeachment at this point is not well founded, and I would not support impeachment. I would tell you that with respect to some of these individual issues, surveillance, the Patriot Act, and otherwise, I have voted in opposition to the efforts to expand what I consider to be intrusion into civil liberties, and I continue to be a strong supporter of civil liberties, and I supported veterans' care at home. But I will be as unequivocal as I was with respect to my opposition to the escalation of troops. I do not support impeachment of President Bush. I think that would, number one, is not well-founded, and number two, would be incredibly divisive to the country, just as, quite frankly, the impeachment proceedings of President Clinton were, 10 years ago.
Well, just as a quick follow-up, do you feel that the impeachment of President Clinton, in light of the minor things that he did, stand up to the major things that the Bush administration has done?
Well, I'm not sure I'm going to compare one thing to the other, because I wasn't in Congress in 1996 or 8 or whenever that was undertaken.
But you were alive in America.
I was alive in America. I didn't see the evidence. I'm suggesting to you that at the time that issue came to fore, I thought it wound up being very divisive for America, and I didn't have a position to take, and certainly wasn't privy to a lot of the information that people were. It seems to me that there were a number of errors made in that process, and I don't want to repeat those errors again.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. The criticism certainly has been made of the Bush administration that it has taken a very expansive view of presidential power, and that has come, some people would say, that has come at the expense of the Congress and congressional power. And I think also some people have been critical of the last Congress, where the Republicans were the majority party, for their unwillingness to do anything to criticize the president, to embarrass the president, and that perhaps the Congress should have stood up and said, well, Mr. President, we think that our role here is being minimized, and we're not going to do that. We're not going to allow you to do that. It doesn't matter whether we share the same party. We're not going to allow you to do that.
Well, I think that's a point well made, David. I'm sure you read, as many of your listeners read, Congressional Quarterly, which is probably one of the most, if not the most respected, weekly analysis of the ongoings of Congress, yearly analysis of the ongoings of Congress that of any publication, unbiased, that there is. While I have supported my president where I thought he was right, I have also opposed my president where I thought he was wrong. And consistently, over the course of those 7 years, I've been rated one of the most, generally between one of the 5 and 10 or 15 most independent Republicans in the entire United States Congress, for precisely the reason that you've articulated. When the president's right on economic policy, the president's right on alternative fuels, when the president's right on certain targeted tax cuts, I've supported him. And when he's wrong on certain civil liberties issues, when he's wrong on environmental issues, when he's wrong on certain labor issues, I've opposed him. And I think that's one of the reasons why I've co-chaired, along with Steve Israel from New York, the Center Aisle Caucus, whose objective is reasonable dialogue and reasonable compromise of people who are not wedded to political ideology. And while they're proud to be Republicans or Democrats, as the case may be, their primary motivation and boss, so to speak, are the people of their district and their consciences. And I think I've voted that way.
Well, let's talk with some other people who are here with us by telephone. Let's go to Urbana. This is line two.
See, what I've managed to do, David, over the course of these 7 years is to get the worst of all worlds. I am sure that every single listener calling in could cherry-pick a variety of issues that they don't agree with me on. So have at it.
All right. Well, let's go here. We have a call here, line two in Urbana. Hello.
Okay. Thank you very much for taking my call. Given the costs of the war, can you anticipate funding of federal research that's critical to the survival and growth of the university, which, of course, is so important to your district? And if so, do you see a pay-as-you-go sort of budget being developed, or do you support a deficit spending to fund the war?
No, I think that's a point well made. Let me be, I'm not evading the question, but since the issue was just voted on, let me bring attention to what the CR, the continuing resolution that funds the government through the end of the fiscal year, did yesterday, just so you can. First of all, I agree. There are huge resources being spent with respect to Iraq, both human resources and economic. I will tell you, this was a very controversial vote yesterday, and I supported it, and there's certainly some aspects of it that I'm not entirely enthralled with, but there were also certain provisions within the CR that were very, very good. There's an increase of $200 million in the Department of Energy Office of Science. There's an increase of $300 million in the Department of Energy Renewable Energies. There's a $335 million increase in the NSF funding. There's a huge increase in EPA Clean Water, $600 million in NIH funding, about $615 million increase in Pell Grants. And so we're doing the best we can, and I believe the University of Illinois would tell you that our stewardship, and I can't take single-handed credit for this by any means, since I've been in Congress with respect to the University of Illinois, is very good. But if your question is, are we losing objectives and are we allocating priorities in terms of money spent in questionable endeavors that could be better spent elsewhere, absolutely yes.
Well, thank you very much for your support of the university.
Thank you.
Let's go to line three. This is also someone in Urbana. Hello.
Let me also point out before we go ahead,
sure,
for the first time in many, many years, the continuing resolution did what I've been calling for since before I was elected, and that is that it blocked a congressional pay raise. It blocked the automatic COLA increase that Congress has voted itself for time immemorial. So I'm happy with that as well.
All right. Well, here, again, we have a caller, line three. Urbana, go ahead.
Good morning. I'd just like to make a couple of corrections to what Representative Johnson has said. First of all, Justice O'Connor was not Chief Justice. She was Justice.
No, I corrected myself. I know she was just a Justice.
Secondly, in response to the first caller, Mr. Johnson said he did not choose the witnesses at the field hearing. In fact, he did call me to participate.
In I did.
He told me he was choosing them, and at the hearing he even said that he called the Peoria tribe and invited them to attend.
Before you go ahead with your comment, I did call you out of courtesy to you, but I did not indicate.
Okay, guys,
that
let me finish. Somebody has to go.
Let me
correct your misstatement. I called you and indicated to you out of courtesy that I was calling to indicate that I would recommend to the committee that you be a witness, because you've been a leader in the opposition to the chief. The witness, the committee acceded to that. We had huge numbers of requests to be witnesses. Those were all submitted to the committee. I did not handpick anybody. I suggested to individuals a variety of names, some of whom the committee selected and some of whom they didn't select, which is precisely what I said a few moments ago, which was precisely the situation. Now, if extending you that courtesy is something that you object to, I'm sorry to have extended you that courtesy.
All right. Now, if the caller would like to talk, if we have more than one guy talking at once, we can't understand what anybody is saying. Well, and now apparently the caller, maybe I have angered him by putting him on hold. My apologies. If he wants to call back, he can redirect.
Well, I just want to be very clear about what I said and what I didn't. That was Mr. Kaufman who called in, who, as you know, is a strong opponent of the chief, and I respect that. I know that him being a strong opponent of the chief and Chapin Rose being a strong proponent of the chief, I called them both individually myself and said, in fairness to both sides of the issue, I've suggested to the committee that you be called as witnesses. I can't control the committee, but would suggest it. Mr. Kaufman did suggest several other individuals, as Chapin Rose, I'm sure, suggested several other individuals would be witnesses. The hearing was a very limited hearing, where there were only six witnesses the committee chose to hear. There were hundreds who would have chosen to testify. And I simply recommended to them that this would be a good witness. I don't have the ability, as not a member of the committee. The chairman is a very strong-minded individual. Mr. McEwen and his staff are the ones who decided how many witnesses there be, when they could talk, and how long they could talk, and that was done accordingly. So any indication that I stated anything incorrectly is absolutely false.
Okay, we are at our actually a little bit past the midpoint here. Our guest is Tim Johnson. He's a Republican congressman representing the 15th Congressional District, Champaign-Urbana part of that, a lot of other cities as well. Big part of the part of the state of Illinois here, and certainly it's a big part of our coverage area. And occasionally we ask him to be on the program so that people who are in the district can ask questions. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We actually do have someone in Kankakee, not in the 15th, but we'll go ahead and take this caller on our line 4. Hello.
Greetings, Congressman. Unfortunately, Kankakee is not presently a part of the 15th, but perhaps
will be
after the 2010 census.
Yeah, it used to be.
I was wondering if the congressman has studied some films. If so, could you comment on them, and if not, could you be...
I didn't quite understand the question.
Your caller is wondering if the congressman has studied certain films. If so, could you comment on them, and if not, would you be willing to study them? Also, your caller would appreciate the directors of these films being given the opportunity to testify before a congressional hearing. The films are Fahrenheit 9-1-1, Bowling for Columbine, Joyeux Noël, Iraq for Sale, The War Profiteers, Why We Fight, and The Fog of War.
No, I've not. If those are movies or films, I've not seen any of those. Huh?
Okay, and I guess I'm really not quite sure I understand what the caller's getting at, other than the fact that they're all anti-war and anti-Bush administration movies.
Yeah, I don't. Question, you know, whether they're appropriate or not appropriate movies. I think the question was that I had a chance to watch the movies, and the answer is no. Frankly, the last movie I watched, I took my two grandsons to see the movie Cars at the Savoy Theater, and I fell asleep, and that's the only movie I think I've seen in the last 8 or 10 years. So my movie going is pretty limited.
Let me ask you about a couple of other things. In his State of the Union speech, on the domestic side, the president concentrated on a number of things. And let me ask you about at least one or two, and maybe we could at some point get to all of them. One of them was health care. And the president made a reference to the fact that there are something like 47 million Americans who don't have health insurance. And then he made this proposal that would provide a tax deduction to people who are paying out of their own pockets for their health insurance. And then also one of the provisions, one of his proposals would be is that for some people who are lucky enough to have health care provided by their employers, they would face a tax on some of their benefits. And I think that I think that may in fact be a non-starter as far as Congress is concerned. But I think a lot of people ask the question, well, what would that do it would only put, if anything, a tiny dent in the number of people who don't have health insurance. I just wonder what you think about the proposals.
Well, I'm enthusiastic, as I've said previously, about at least the president in his State of the Union addressing the issue of adjustment of the tax code to provide increased access. I have not studied in depth the proposals. I don't even know if there's legislation yet that embodies it. I know there is a suggestion that the families with health insurance wouldn't pay income tax or payroll tax on the first $15,000, and I think singles $7,500. Mm-hmm. The idea then being a fairly complicated formula that I understand would mean a tax reduction and more coverage for about 80% of the people, and au contraire for about 20% of the more wealthy. Now, how that actually plays out and how that would be calculated in terms of one's tax return, I haven't looked at in great detail. I did see, I think a week ago in the Sunday Trib or Sun Times, saw an actual spreadsheet in terms of how that would work. I certainly want to keep an open mind to it, But other than simply being fairly enthusiastic about at least addressing the issue and some creative proposals, I haven't seen it in detail. I do know there have been more detailed proposals, David, with respect to association health plans, which, as you probably know, allow small businesses to band together to leverage their purchasing power to establish what amounts to nationwide health plans through their associations. And likewise, the health savings accounts, which are already in partial existence. And I think some of those proposals are very, very good. But I don't think there's any panacea, there's no silver bullet that addresses what's clearly a problem and a crisis in the United States, and that is better health care coverage for more people.
Let me ask you one other thing, again, about another issue. I think probably if you ask the president what he thought were his greatest achievements during the time that he's been president and in the domestic area, I'm sure that near the top of the list would be No Child Left Behind. That legislation, school reform legislation that's known as No Child Left Behind. It has been somewhat controversial. I think people in education have questioned whether that was the right approach. There have been concerns about funding. We're now at the point where it's up for renewal. Let me just ask you, do you think, in fact, that it will be renewed?
I think in some form it will be renewed. As you remember, David, when the president first took office, he and Senator Kennedy, which is a fairly uncommon combination, coalesced to create or at least author No Child Left Behind, whose objectives are very, very good, and whose objectives I strongly support. The implementation, however, and the failure in some cases of administrative bodies to recognize that one size does not in fact fit all, and that the classic mandate, either at a federal state level, without appropriate funding, is something that's less than desirable. And so I think administrators, teachers, my good friend Joan Dykstra teaches out in the Lincoln Trail schools in Mahomet and would continually tell me that we're teaching to the test rather than to the students with respect to No Child Left Behind. And she's a strong supporter of the objectives of No Child Left Behind. So I think when we revisit the issue, it needs to be more than tweaked, and it needs to address the issues in a very specific way that in a good many cases have not been adequately addressed through broad-based legislation, well-intended and in some cases very effectively having been authored and implemented.
Well, is there anything in particular that stands out on your mind as something that about this that you would like to see changed or something that done?
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, I think it does not recognize adequately in terms of the parameters of the testing process the difference between large urban schools and smaller rural schools. It doesn't recognize the relevance of and role to play of learning disabled students. And I think those are two areas in particular that I don't think people in authoring this, and I think well-intended, recognized would be the problems that they have. And so anytime you have an idea that works fairly well, you need to always be willing to go back and look at it and see where you can make it work better and where you can prevent it from being an impediment rather than an improvement.
All right. Let's get some other callers. Oh, by the way, just real quick, someone called in and wanted to know when you would be in Sedaris.
Sedaris?
Yeah.
I should be there before noon today.
Okay. This morning, then.
Yes.
Let's go on to
on my way to Bement.
Some other callers here. To Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
I had a question on private property. I know you supported a bill a couple of years ago, the Private Property Rights Protection
Act. On the Kelo case?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's, trapped in committee in the Senate? But I was wondering, in this Congress, do you think that will eventually become law?
I think that's a great question, and I certainly hope so. As you're aware, a couple of years ago, the Supreme Court rendered what I consider to be one of the most outrageous decisions in the history of the United States Supreme Court, where in effect they gave units of government, units of local government and otherwise, the ability to use eminent domain to condemn private property rather than for public use, for private use, which obviously opens up tremendous potential for abuse in that whole arena. So we've introduced legislation to specifically cut off funding in some cases and provide a number of other swords of Damocles over the heads of units of government who use the eminent domain power, which was never intended to do anything other than provide for the most limited uses, specifically schools, roads, and so forth. when they're used for private development. Because the ultimate people who are going to suffer from the use of that expansive power are ordinary citizens, and it's the big money folks who are going to benefit, because they simply go in, determine that your house is an appropriate place for a Walmart, and have the government, the unit of local government, condemn your land and give it to Walmart, and that's the end of the game. And to me, that is an outrageous abuse, and something that we have met in varying degrees, but I think that need to pass in either stronger degrees. And I think the state of Illinois already has in place very strong legislation, and I think even bolstered it some this time with respect to the protection against the abuse of those eminent domain powers. But certainly nationwide, that's something that needs to be the policy of our government.
Did I get at the caller's question?
Yeah, well, I agree. I guess I was just wondering if you had any sense as to when you might have something on the president's desk. Do you think it'll be in a year or two? Or?
Well, I can't. I don't know specifically when that we'll get there, because we've obviously just opened the 110th Congress, so things are still unfolding under new leadership, and how sympathetic the new leadership's going to be to what I'm talking about is yet to be determined.
Well, keep up the good work. Thank you.
Well, thank you,
thanks
sir.
For the call. Let's go to Paris. That's line three. Hello.
I was just in Paris on Saturday, actually.
Were you? Well, yep. I just left there headed to Champagne. New job.
Well, traded positions, huh?
Big Tim EV supporter. A couple things. We voted you in, and your job is to make it happen, but a couple things you said earlier bothered me a little bit. When they asked you what your position was, you kind of skirted around that and told us what other people's position was, and you kind of supported that. I'd like to hear
a little more on
what your position on Iraq was, and when you kept saying when the president's wrong, I voted against him, or I went against him, and when the president was right. I think that should, in my opinion, should have been when you thought the president's position when you thought
that's,
the president's
that's right. You're absolutely
was wrong.
Right. No, I didn't state that as well as I should. People
but anyhow, that's all I had to say, and I really appreciate it. I want to get off here so more people can
talk. Well, thanks for the call.
No, yeah. Thanks for the call, Nick. My folks in Paris have been extraordinarily supportive of me, and that's almost like my home away from home, and I appreciate how kind people have been to me. As I said, I went to a number of events, including John Morris's parents' house, to watch part of the second half of the Illini game on Saturday. I didn't intentionally skirt around the question, and the caller is correct. I have, when the president's right, I've supported the president. When the president's positions are right, I have not supported the president. I don't think I skirted around Iraq. I said, and I think it's pretty well history, that I voted in favor of the authorization of force, and have supported and continue to support appropriations for our men and women, and have been in Paris a number of times, actually, when the troops came home. I'm very proud of them. I do not, however, believe that sending an additional 22,000 troops to Iraq is in our national best interest. I think what we're doing, as I said then, is to send additional men and women into harm's way with no definable objective. And to that extent, I can't support, and I think people across the philosophical spectrum don't support, this escalation in troops. But I think the caller is correct. I think I probably should have articulated better by saying, when our president is right in his position on issues, I've supported them. And when he is not, I felt right on his position on issues, I've not supported those. But I'm certainly a friend of President Bush, and I make no apologies about that.
All right, let's go to Mattoon. This is line four.
It's also in Mattoon on Saturday.
Hello there. Go ahead, caller. Mattoon, line four.
I wonder if you would comment on your position on this stem cell.
On what now?
Research. Stem cell research and universal health coverage. I know I thought years and years ago we'd have it by now, but we don't. And also the problem of securing a safety net for Social Security.
Well,
Social Security's
in. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, if we had between now and 5 o'clock this afternoon, I'm not sure I could probably adequately address all three issues.
Well, I just maybe your position on it.
Well, let me just address the Social Security issue, since that's my memory is one that's immediate, and that's the one you mentioned last. I think it's critical that we address the problem of the solvency of Social Security. And it's a system that by 2017 is apparently going to start paying out more than it takes in. And by 2042, in the absence of nuances, is going to go partially defunct. No one's going to let that happen. It is essential that we assure the safety of Social Security, we assure that it remains a safety net, and that we address the issue for our children and our grandchildren. I think some of the proposals that have been made have been very, very drastic, and ones that I think don't address the solvency issue. And I think it is critical that we not make changes in a system unless they're very carefully made and intended in a small way to assure the solvency of the system and still maintain the safety net. As far as universal health care, I'm not sure whether you're making reference to the proposal that was made during the election by my opponent or whether you're simply talking about the hopeful access for more Americans on a wider basis to health care. If you're talking about the latter,
I support it. Well, I'm thinking in terms like putting everybody on Medicare.
Well, I'm not sure that there's ever been that proposal made. If the proposal is that the government run the health care system, I don't support that. I think it means poorer quality health care services at a higher cost. I think it means long waits, and I think it means an interminable bureaucracy that wouldn't work well for the American people.
How about stem cell research?
But federal government subsidies or stem cell research generally?
The government supporting stem cell research.
I support use of federal dollars to help in research in stem cells in certain areas where I think the federal dollars are most appropriately used.
In other words, it's a narrow view then.
Well, I don't know if you can consider it narrow. I guess the beauty is in the eye of the beholder. We only have a limited amount of federal dollars to go around, and I think those should be used in areas where the dollars are most effectively used.
You prefer the states to do it?
The state government?
Yes.
Well, I prefer that the private sector do it in most cases because if there's dollars to be made in addressing issues of Alzheimer's and diabetes and otherwise, and they work well, the private sector is going to be all over that. I do think it's appropriate to provide federal dollars and state dollars where that's appropriate, but in limited areas and in effective uses. And my view of things is that the areas of effective federal dollars, state dollars, have been need to be addressed in a very targeted way, and I would support limited federal dollars in that area.
Well, thank you very much. I think I understand your position.
All right. Okay. Well, thanks for the call. Just to stay for a second with Social Security, I think somebody, at least one commentator that I read, pointed out that 2 years ago in the State of the Union speech, Social Security was a main focus, and that in the president's most recent speech, it was hardly mentioned at all. He obviously, when he was starting out his second term, decided this was something he was going to put a major focus on and spent a lot of time. He traveled all over the country, had all these town meetings and made speeches, and it seemed that he had a hard time persuading people either that there was a problem or that he had the right solution. Do you think it's likely even in this Congress over the next 2 years that anything's really going to happen?
I think that Rick Winkle used to refer to school funding being the third rail of state government, I think Social Security in some ways is the third rail of federal government. No one wants to touch it because it has such potential ramifications. I think the president and opponents and proponents both of change probably's rhetoric didn't always coincide with the reality of the Social Security system. There were a lot of proposals made that would have dramatically changed the system but probably would not have impacted the solvency of the underlying system. And I think that's what we've got to address. We've got to address the fact that there are more and more people of my age who are living a lot longer, and the fact that there are more and more or less and less people my grandchildren's age who are born to support and pay into the system. And so there's a logical demographic imbalance that need to be addressed in very nuanced ways. But that doesn't mean that we need to eliminate or even suggest eliminating the safety net that underlies Social Security. But it also doesn't mean we need to be an ostrich and presume that the problem is going to go away, and that we have no problem, because we do. We just need to address it in a responsible way.
We just have about 5 minutes. We have a number of callers. We'll get as many as we can. We'll go next to Urbana Line 2. Hello.
Yes, I would like to add further clarity to an issue that was discussed before by quoting from Congressman Johnson's testimony at the field hearing at Parkland College, and I quote, this is Mr. Johnson's testimony. He stated, quote, "Before we get started, I must point out that my office reached out to the Peoria Tribe of Indians of Oklahoma so we could hear their perspective. Unfortunately, they were not able to send a representative. I also sent an extended an invitation to Ronald Toya, an American Indian who has studied the use of Native American imagery, unquote, for Mr. Johnson now to blame Congressman McKeon, the chair of the committee, for the lack of participation of Native Americans, and to disavow his role in inviting all the people who did promote present testimony is disingenuous. And I think his own words speak to that.
Well, what Mr. Kaufman wanted at the hearing, and we didn't provide, or I didn't provide at the hearing, was a ongoing debate with Mr. Kaufman and myself, and I don't intend to engage in that now. I told you precisely what was done, and I changed nothing that I said.
All right, we'll go on to another caller. This is someone on cell phone line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm interested in the Kelo decision and in the claim that there's something outrageous about it. As I understood the decision, it looked to me as if the Supreme Court was sort of getting out of the way of local politics and letting local politics respond to these questions. Usually when the court gets in the business of protecting individual rights, it does so because the majoritarian democratic process can't be trusted to do so instead. But instead, in the wake of that decision, what we've seen is an outpouring of legislative responses that suggest that the rights at issue are quite resonant with the people. So what the court has done is gotten out of the way to permit local experimentation and local decision-making to control the extent of the eminent domain power. And I'm puzzled by the congressman's notion that this should be resolved at the federal level.
When any legislative body at any level violates clear constitutional guidelines, and we're talking about the United States Constitution, then I believe that the Congress or the state legislature have the obligation to step in. I think the caller would agree that if local units of government were to move back to the 1800s and various kinds of social policy, that we shouldn't say that's simply a matter of the ability of local government to do. And in my judgment, and I think in the judgment of an overwhelming number of people, when a unit of local government or any unit of government can use eminent domain powers, condemnation powers, sweeping powers to take individuals' property and use them for the use of other developers, big developers, that is an abuse that needs to be addressed by the appropriate level of government. And since this was a United States Supreme Court decision, I think there was a feeling on both sides of the aisle that this is an abuse that needs to be addressed. The response to Kelo came from individuals from the very far liberal end of the spectrum as well as the conservative end. And I don't think any of the listeners who are listening to this show now can honestly tell me that they think we should leave untrammeled the ability of any unit of government to take an individual's property and his or her family's property to use for Walmart when the unit of local government somehow feels in their discretion that that's better public policy. That is untrammeled private socialism.
Does the caller want to follow up at all?
Well, I don't think that's what the Kelo decision stands for.
I read the Kelo decision.
As you well
have you read
know,
it?
There's no Walmart development.
No, there isn't, but the precedent is still precisely
right,
the same.
David, I'm sorry. It doesn't sound like the representative wants to discuss this rationally, so I'll just step back.
Well, we are getting very short on time in any case, and I think I would like to try to get at least one more person in here, and that would be a caller on another cell phone person, the caller number, line number three. Hello.
Hello. This is a call about rising car rates in central Illinois and global warming. I've become aware of a company called Citizenry. It's citizenry.org. And something I'd like to see happen in central Illinois, but it's only happening in Chicago right now, is that there are some power companies that work with this company to do solar installations on people's houses. It's low cost. The company takes the cost. I think the partnership is with, in Chicago, Commonwealth Ed, and then they assume the cost of the installation, and presumably they can do this because they don't have to build another power plant or something of that kind. I see that Ameren doesn't support that now. I just wonder if the congressman has any interest in pursuing this particular or other similar means to combat both rising power rates, sharply rising power rates, and global warming.
Oh, absolutely. I wasn't aware of either the proposal or the company. But solar energy, wind power, and other alternative source of energy, any opportunity that I have to get more information on what we can do to appropriately address those as alternative energy sources, I'd be real enthusiastic about. So whatever you can supply us in regard to that, I'd be real happy to receive.
One more thing. The president, in his speech, also talked about energy in the State of the Union. He talked about wanting to increase production of renewable fuels, ethanol, and, of course, the farmers thought that was would obviously think that would be a good idea. He also did talk about raising fuel economy standards of cars, which have not changed in a long time. I think the one thing that people have said is that they believe that the government could be tougher about this, could be more aggressive, could set the standards higher and then require car makers to meet them more quickly. And overall, that would be a good thing if it reduced the amount of gasoline that we burn.
No, absolutely. In fact, I have joined as a sponsor in legislation to increase the CAFE standards for automobiles. And that's something we can specifically and aggressively do. We have passed that in various forms, and it's been held up in the Senate. This is a bill that's sponsored. I'm a co-sponsor along with Representative Boehlert and Markey in the last session, which would increase the CAFE standards, David, up to 33 miles a gallon. And I certainly support that and would support that in the future.
And would that include also trucks and SUVs, or is that just for passenger
cars?
Oh, no.
There's obviously varying standards, but absolutely it would support vehicles across the board.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it at that. We've come to the end of the time. I'm sorry we have one more caller we can't take, but perhaps on another day we can do it again. In the meantime, Congressman, thanks very much.
Thank you, David.
Our guest, Congressman Tim Johnson, he's a Republican. He represents the 15th Congressional District in Illinois.